Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran warns the European Union against irrational acts of meddling over the recent riots in the country. Several explosions hit a central area in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, amid reports of intense fighting in Donbas. And Brazil's incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro hits his leftist challenger, Lula da Silva, 2 weeks to go before the runoff elections. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Tehran is warning the European Union against irrational acts of meddling against Iran over the recent riots in the country. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says Iran will respond in kind to any new measures by the bloc or its member states. Kanani also slammed European countries for applying double standards to riots in Iran and elsewhere. Kanani says that they are calling on Iran not to counter riots while they counter rioters in their own countries. Some European officials have criticized Iran for its response to the unrest that followed the death of a young Iranian woman last month. The European Council is set to discuss the issue in a meeting on Monday, and it could impose sanctions on Iran. The Iranian president has denounced his U.S. counterpart for inciting chaos, terror, and destruction in Iran by voicing support for riots.
The U.S. president allows himself to make comments on Iran riots. He has made such comments two or three times in the last couple of days. It's a regret that those who claim to be supporters of human rights, security, peace, and stability support riot, terror, and chaos in Iran.
Ebrahim Raisi's comments came shortly after Biden called the Iranian government oppressive for what he called a crackdown on popular protests. The U.S. president also expressed surprise at, in his own words, the courage of people and women taking to the streets. Raisi now says that the U.S. officials are angered whenever the Iranian nation takes an innovative and positive step, and they are thrilled to see Iran face difficulties or unrest. The president says the U.S. has played a role in many riots, acts of sabotage, and terror in the region. He cited the U.S.'s 20-year occupation of Afghanistan or its support for Israel's atrocities. Raisi says that the Iranian nation knows its enemies and will prevent them from reaching their goals. Tim Anderson is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. He tells us how various U.S. administrations have done all they could to weaken Iran.
I think it's very well known by now that Washington, whatever the administration is there, whether it's Obama or Trump or Biden, is going to use all of the resources at their disposal to try and weaken, divide, undermine Iran. And every new opportunity will be seized on, basically, because, of course, we know their style of warfare these days is a lot more to do with using proxies, the proxies like the MEK, like the proxies that are in the northern Iraq, like the proxies that are used against Syria, for example, and a constant stream of propaganda to weaken or to confuse their own audiences, principally, basically. I don't think that's really confusing the Iranians, though. It's a long-standing practice of the U.S., and it's emerged in public, and they're not even embarrassed to say it now. They want to starve people, make them desperate, make them rise up against the government, because they know, as they said about Cuba 60 years ago, they said they knew that the Fidel Castro was very popular. The only way for them to try and overthrow the regime there was to make the people desperate and starve. And similarly, you recall Mike Pompeo a few years ago saying that if the Iranian people wanted to eat, they would have to comply with US demands. So it's a very open, direct assault. Of course, it's illegal. It shouldn't be called sanctions. These coercive measures are illegal measures under international law, but they are specifically designed to make people desperate and try and divide people.
The Iranian judiciary says 4 more inmates have died due to the blaze at Tehran's Evin prison on Friday. The prisoners were earlier said to be in critical condition. Their deaths take the number of lives lost in the fire incident to 8. The judiciary earlier said dozens of inmates were also injured. The blaze started at the prison sewing workshop following a brawl over involving a group of prisoners. Meanwhile, security guards said that they foiled an attempt of prison break by some of the inmates convicted of violent and dangerous crimes. The situation has returned to normal in the prison. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has launched military drills in border areas in 2 northwestern provinces. The exercises are conducted by the IRGC's ground force in the Aras River region, which borders Azerbaijan Republic and Armenia. On the agenda of the drills are heli-borne operations, night combat, and river crossing exercises, among others. Helicopters and various types of drones will also be deployed. The Ground Forces Commander Brigadier General Mohammad Pakpour says the exercise is part of their scheduled annual missions aimed at boosting their combat readiness. Pakpour says the drills send a message of peace and friendship to neighbors and a message of a warning to enemies that such armed forces will give a firm response to any threat. The British capital, London, has hosted this year's annual Islamic Unity Conference. The event brings together religious leaders of various Muslim sects under one roof to promote peace and combat division. This year's conference comes amid a global campaign targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran. Robert Carter reports.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change, following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Velayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
Several explosions have hit central Kiev for the second time in a week. damaging several residential buildings. Local officials say the city was hit four times in the early morning attack. They say one of the targets was Kiev's central train station. The city was hit with several explosions last week when Russia staged a massive missile attack into Ukraine in retaliation for a blast on a bridge linking mainland Russia to Crimea. Separately, officials in Ukraine's eastern region say that a big fire broke out at an energy facility there after a missile hit it. This comes as a Russian and Ukrainian forces are engaged in heavy fighting around Donetsk and Lugansk in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. Earlier, our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us from Donetsk with more details.
In Kiev today, we're woken up by the sound of a Russian bombing of the capital. It's not clear all the targets yet. You mentioned the train station. It's also looks like it's been confirmed that the headquarters of the main Ukrainian energy company has also been hit. This is in line with Russia's new policy to start hitting civil infrastructure and particularly power stations, energy infrastructure. This, of course, helps to inhibit Ukraine's ability on the battlefield, but also will make life more difficult for civilians.
Clashes have erupted between French police and angry demonstrators who rallied in the capital, Paris, to protest against soaring living costs and climate inaction. Police used tear gas and pepper spray to disperse the protesters, who in return threw objects at security forces. The protesters were also pushing against proposed pension reforms. The demonstration was called by left-wing political parties backed by hundreds of associations. France has already been hit by weeks of refinery strikes that have caused fuel shortages across the country. The workers demand wage hikes to cover inflation and include a share of the huge profits made by oil companies. Prime Minister has warned striking oil industry workers that the government might require them to go back to work to ease the fuel shortages. Political commentator John Stepling explains how the people of France are finding it difficult to get by with the ongoing cost of living crisis.
The cost of living has risen so precipitously. The gas prices are amazingly high, even in Scandinavia here. Food prices have risen far beyond anything that's actually even reported. And again, this is true even in a country like Norway. So people are reaching a point where it's not sustainable for them. And winter, of course, is coming, and the prospect of having to heat your house in the winter months, especially in northern European countries, is causing people a great deal of anxiety. And the governments of Europe have no answer for this. In the EU, Ursula von der Leyen just keeps repeating the same sort of mantra about we have to send weapons and money to Ukraine and so forth. Prices are just unrealistically high. I mean, impossible for people to survive if they stay at this level. Impossible for them to heat their homes in winter if they stay at this level. Just literally impossible.
The top EU diplomat, Joseph Borrell, is under increasing fire for a recent analogy that he made. In it, he drew what many have described as a racist and offensive contrast between Europe and the rest of the world. The remarks sent social media into a frenzy. Let's take a listen to some of those reactions. But first, Joseph Borrell himself.
Yes, Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. Everything works. It's the best combination of political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that the humankind has been able to build. The rest of the world, and you know very well, Federica, is not exactly a garden. the rest of the world, most of the rest of the world is a jungle. And the jungle could invade the garden. And the gardeners should take care of it in order to protect the garden. The gardeners have to go to the jungle. The European has to be much more engaged with the rest of the world. Otherwise, the rest of the world will invade us by different ways and means.
Is Africa still a jungle only meant to furnish someone else's garden, as it has painfully been so? You looted the jungle for generations to build your garden, sit down. Years ago, war criminal Prime Minister Ehud Barak described Israel as a village in the jungle. Today, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell describes the EU as a garden in the jungle. These truly are the shared values of these putrid racist colonialists.
This racist's garden only grows because of everything he and those he represents steal from the jungle.
The candidates in Brazil's runoff presidential elections have traded jabs and insults in their first debate, 2 weeks to go before the vote. Leftist challenger Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva attacked far-right incumbent Jair Bolsonaro by calling him a little dictator and a king of fake news. Bolsonaro pushed back, calling Lula a national shame. Handling of COVID-19 corruption were the main issues that were discussed. Meanwhile, according to the latest opinion polls, Lula enjoys a 49% support against 44% for Bolsonaro. Both fell short of the 50% threshold needed to win the presidency in the first round of the elections on October the 2nd. And tensions are rising between the United States and Saudi Arabia over the recent decision by OPEC Plus to cut oil production. The U.S. National Security Advisor says President Joe Biden will act, quote, methodically in reevaluating Washington's relationship with Riyadh. Jake Sullivan added that American president has no plans to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman at the upcoming G20 summit in Indonesia. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Suppose if I get closer, I can take a better picture. Let me see it. That's it. This suspension bridge is one in a million. If I stand on this bridge, I can surely take better pictures. But I think it's a little bit scary. Much scary. Though, I'm brave enough. Before I forget, I've made a trip to Khalkhal County in order to visit Pir Taqi Suspension Bridge. And if you're brave enough, stay with me. Taqi Suspension Bridge is located in Khalkhal County of Ardabil Province, northwest of Iran. This bridge is one of the tourist attractions of the region, spanning 165 meters with a 60-meter height over the Qizil-Ozan River. Constructed by professional engineers and workers, Pir Taqi Suspension Bridge is built with wire ropes and lumbers. This fantastic bridge was actually made for the convenience of Pir Taqi Dam construction workers, and today just a limited number of people can walk through it. A fabulous place for hours of rock and mount climbing, the attraction will amaze visitors. Some would like to stop by and watch the astonishing scene for a couple of hours. Photography lovers will adore the extraordinary glamour of the site. Mineral spas are part of the journey. The cool waters are so refreshing. For the venturesome trip, you might need comfortable shoes, raincoat, first aid kit, light meals, and bottles of water. Well, I have to take a walk from the point I parked my car. Not a long way to go. You have to be well equipped, and I am, like always. Just imagine a hanging bridge with no column, no stand on the earth. Wow, this is what it is. Hanging between the sky and the earth. I am very eager to walk through it. I'm so close. Couldn't imagine to climb that high. Oh, some parts are very steep. Scared to fall. Kidding. It was a perfect route. But I have to climb carefully. What is important is that I can take great photos from that height. The stunning scenery. Mitra, resist! Resist! You can reach the top. Here's the last station. Amazing! Oh, wow! Look at the bridge. Built with wire ropes and lumbers. It has a wooden floor. I like it. It's unique. Let me see. What a photo. Now, let me walk through the bridge. You know, if you're acrophobic, you should avoid this bridge. And this bridge can only place a limited number of people. Otherwise, it would be very dangerous. Oh, yes. I hold fast to these wires, not looking beneath. It's a mixed feeling. Excitement, fear, suspension. Oh God, forget everything. Just look at the spectacular scenery. And the river. Listen, it's roaring. Qizil Ozan is one of the roaring rivers of Iran. Oh, I don't want to miss the landscape. Let me see. Aha. Great. Well, it started raining seconds ago, and I have to leave this astonishing bridge. It's a fantastic experience, but don't forget to take safety precautions into consideration. And if you're afraid of height, you can just enjoy the scenery around the bridge. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The rally against soaring living costs and climate inaction has been held in the French capital, Paris. This might as well take place in many European cities that have been plagued by the same crisis. namely a cost of living crisis. Why are European countries not able to resolve their economic problems? Is it purely because of a lack of energy and high inflation? And is this all because of the Ukraine conflict? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will dig deep to see if European politicians, like the ones in France, are prepared to make sacrifices for their citizens and not just follow the U.S. lead. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Paolo Raffone joins us. He's the Secretary General at the SIPPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels. Also joining us, George Samioli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute of the London Metropolitan University, who joins us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Paolo Raffone. Looking at what has happened in France, you're looking at, first of all, the protests, which the really huge, it was a huge protest. 140,000 is the tally they showed, that people came out and they basically marched against what was called the rising cost of living and government inaction against climate change. If you saw the protests, what do you think? And what do you think about the two causes that they came out for?
Well, the protest was quite huge. Well, France is a big country. There were protests also in other parts of Europe. For instance, in Brussels, where I live, was much more modest, were 4,000 people more or less. But anyway, it was significant. I think it is the beginning of a process all over Europe. People are tired of leaders who are supporting on the humanitarian ground a country that has been aggressed, but on the other side, they are destroying the daily life of people in Europe, and huge amounts of money are diverted towards the war issues, even if it is for humanitarian reasons, but it is not only, as we know, it's for armaments as well. And people are tired. I mean, they just came out of 2 years of pandemic, and they do not want to listen to this kind of approach any longer, and they're taking the streets. This is the beginning, in my opinion.
George Samioli, is this the beginning?
I think so. The cold weather will soon be hitting Europe. It's still been relatively mild, but it's obviously coming very soon. And already we've seen the soaring energy prices throughout Europe. People are unable to pay their bills, their electricity bills, their gas bills. And given also the enormous pressure coming from rising inflation, you've got the a truly powerful, explosive mix. And once people suddenly start feeling cold and they're feeling hungry, and if, as is likely, a recession is also coming, that means they're also going to be out of work and out of money, then there is going to be a very, very bitter winter.
I'm curious, Paolo Raffone, if the politicians, if the ones who are in the governments, who are in power, are looking at these protests, and I'm wondering what they're thinking. I mean, do you think that they're looking at it, and are they going to come out with any kind of explanation as to what they should prepare the general public for?
Well, they're trying to say half sentences, but in fact, people do not trust them any longer. All of them, I mean, in all countries and at European level. I mean, the way they've been handling the pandemic before and now the issue of this war has demonstrated their incapacity, and people are really tired of this. Now, how this will materialize, in which political form or social form, is difficult to say. There will be more protests, as the other colleague was saying, because of the conditions of living which are deteriorating, and the more it will be in the coming months. So how this will materialize in political terms is difficult to say, but certainly people are discouraged, upset, and disenchanted. And this is not a good mix.
The protests that occurred in France, George Samioli, it's interesting that one of the major reasons for it was what they call the climate crisis. I'm just curious how much that really holds in the bigger picture when we're looking at European governments talking about gas rationing, electricity blackouts. I mean, green energy, if you have an electric car, how can you even pump it with, I shouldn't say pump it, charge it with electricity when you can't afford to pay the bill, electric bill?
I agree with you. I think the current energy crisis obviously has been brought on in part by the sanctions policy that was directed at Russia, and then Russia of retaliating by essentially cutting off gas for Europe. But it's actually of long standing, and I think it's come about because the countries of Europe have for years not invested enough in fossil fuels. They listen too much to Greta Thunberg and the whole idea of moving towards renewables without really thinking through of how feasible this is and how this plan can possibly be bear fruit anytime in the near future. And so because they haven't invested enough in fossil fuels, because also during the pandemic, they didn't replenish their gas supplies, which they should have done because the economy was going to recover and therefore there would be a great demand on gas. Because they've neglected all of this, they've now got themselves into a mess because then they decided to impose sanctions on one of the biggest energy producers in the world without thinking through those consequences. Well, when you've made so many bad decisions, you are going to suffer the consequences. And I think people are going to express their rage against their political leaders.
So since you're talking about Russia there in terms of being obviously a gas producer, Paul Raffone, I don't think it's the best route to go at this point, given what we've seen so far, for the U.S. leading European countries into having this war drag on against Russia, which is the number two producer or number one producer, and then U.S. getting into a spat with Saudi Arabia, the number two producer. So you got the first two out of the way. We know how they feel about Iran. And I think we know how they feel about Venezuela also.
Well, definitely the nonsensical management of this crisis by the United States has only one scope, or it looks like having one scope, that is destroying Europe, and which is a nonsensical scope as well, because if they destroy Europe, they lose the best friend that they had in the world and also the best ally they had. So I simply cannot understand what Americans are up to. Do they really think they can continue governing the world in a unipolar way, imposing their rule everywhere? Or it would be better, as I would suggest, to find a common ground with some kind of compromise with the different types of powers which are not emerging, they are existing. So it's time to wake up and to see the reality.
Who has to wake up? Are you referring to the Europeans?
Europeans and United States, both.
Well, George Samioli, why aren't the Europeans waking up? I mean, first of all, they've come out, both France and Germany, the French, recently, just days ago, the French economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, saying, wait a minute, the U.S. is making out big time, profiting off the gas sales to Europe. At the same time, he has said that this shouldn't be at the behest of the weakening of Europe. I mean, the news is already out there in terms of what is called deindustrialization. I'm sure you've heard of it. Many factories are relocating from Europe into the U.S. So if I'm European officials, aren't they seeing that happen? I mean, at this point, they should say, wait a minute, they're selling us gas, making us huge profits. They're selling us weapons. It seems like the U.S. is not really investing in the war, but the Europeans are somewhat paying for it.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's obviously been the case really from the beginning. It was the United States from the start that has instigated this war. It has pushed Ukraine into taking extreme positions that was bound to cause deep anxiety among Russia. And then when Russia issued warning after warning that you're crossing a red line, you're crossing a red line, the Americans continued to push Ukraine. And it should have been obvious even then to the Europeans, who were by no means that enthusiastic about the idea of bringing Ukraine into NATO, it should have been obvious to them that this war will benefit the United States and Europe not at all. And so Europe was kind of pushed into this confrontation, but the United States, which is, of course, a big energy producer of its own, United States could cope with it, but Europe doesn't produce energy, or at least not very much energy, and Europe was going to be in the front line. And so for the French now to say, and the Germans as well, oh, the Americans are making out like bandits on liquefied natural gas. Yeah, well, that should have been obvious that was always the plan. I mean, the Americans were pushing the Germans already years ago under President Trump to cancel Nord Stream 2. And the Germans went along with it, even though Nord Stream 2 was clearly benefiting the German economy. And by essentially canceling it, Germany has essentially shot itself in the foot. So, you know, it's an unfortunate fact that the Europeans have not shown the kind of leadership that previous generations of European leaders, such as Charles de Gaulle, Willy Brandt, Helmut Schmidt, Helmut Kohl, had shown when they defied the Americans. Because this is a long-standing issue about Europe getting its energy from Russia, or before that with the Soviet Union. The Americans have always tried to thwart this, but European leaders used to have the gumption and the guts to stand up to the United States, but no longer, unfortunately.
Try to break that down for us, Paolo Raffone, if they don't have the willpower to stand up or the guts to stand up to the U.S. What does that exactly mean? I mean, their citizens are suffering and they're losing money. So tell us what that means. Why can't they do that?
Why they can do that? Because the economic and financial system that has been imposed worldwide and in Europe in particular over the past 30 years has created a bunch of yes men educated in the same schools with the same set of mind. And so we do not have any more leaders capable of thinking on their own and to stand up, as the colleague was saying, for the previous old ones, which does not mean to be against the United States, but just to say, well, look, we also have our needs. We are allies. We want to be friends, but we cannot commit suicide. And our leaders are incapable, completely incapable of doing this, particularly on the leftist side. The left has completely lost the capacity of thinking anything which is leftist. And so the only thing that is coming out is this kind of nationalistic or populistic kind of reaction, which is a way to react, of course, but not necessarily the best one to stand up to the United States.
You mentioned Nord Stream, and I have to ask you, George Samueli, do you think the U.S. was responsible for that? I mean, they did the probe. They said there was an act of sabotage that took place. And, of course, we can't forget how Joe Biden earlier in the year had said that we would do what we would stop Nord Stream from operating. How do you see that particular thing that happened?
Well, as always, when there's a crime, the first question you have to ask is qui bono, who benefits? And whoever benefits is the primary suspect. In this case, the United States, which with from one administration to another has been determined to sabotage Nord Stream 2, obviously benefits. And Russia which it's Russia's property. It's Russia. It's a revenue stream for Russia. It's a system of leverage for Russia. Russia stands to benefit not at all from this crime. Germany stands to benefit not at all from this crime. So you'd have to say the likeliest suspect is, of course, the chief beneficiary. And one has to say, the United States hasn't exactly gone out of its way to deny its culpability. Yes, to be sure, it has denied it. But, if it really wasn't responsible, if it really believed that the Russians were behind this, you bet that the Americans would be screaming at the top of their voices, pointing their fingers at Russia. They haven't done that. So you have to say that, they are the likeliest suspects, and their relatively mute response is just further evidence of that.
Paolo Raffone, so looking from this point on forward, I'm trying to paint, or you are going to try to paint a scenario for us, of which I'm going to put forward some analysis of some of the facts put together. When we take a look at the state of the economy of European countries, do you think it would be justified to compare what is happening now to what happened back in 2007, 2008, when the financial crisis broke out, in terms of the strength of the European economies? Because as it stands, it seems like European countries are basing profits on projections of how they're going to, generate revenues. But the revenues are just not happening. Perfect case in point, I think, would be the UK, where they were projecting £60 billion in savings over the course of, I think it was 5 years, but on a 2.7 or 8% GDP growth. But at best, it is said that they're going to grow at 0.7 or 8 tenths of a percent. So that, how are they going to come out of this if the growth is not going to be there, if the revenues are not going to be there for the government?
It would be horrific and painful at social level, because they will, the governments will have to cut spending. That's the reality. I mean, they're talking about a sort of a European mutualization of costs of this situation, but this is a sort of a pipe dream and goes nowhere. The reality is that for the next few months, probably, the situation will increasingly go worse, but not that bad. But during next year will be catastrophic, and especially after the next summer. So how they will respond, I have no idea. I just see a sort of improvisation and a very weak and incapable leadership at all levels.
Mm-hmm. George Samueli, looking forward, if we are to see the disintegration of these economies in one way or another, because at this point it's a somewhat blanket application that we can make on the European countries, if you agree, then we are looking at the Eurozone on very shaky grounds, not that it was on solid grounds before. Do you see this? What's the worst case scenario you see coming up if the Europe continues down this track?
Well, I think obviously serious social unrest will be the first consequence. We're already seeing this in France. There were these big demonstration today, but there's also a big strike. There's going to be more and more of these strikes, because when you have inflation, then people are continually taking pay cuts, and then people obviously respond very badly to pay cuts. But there's obviously going to be serious social crises at the economic heart of Europe, which is Germany, because Germany, powers the European economy. And if German industry will have to start laying people off, if German industry is going to start having to close down factories, industrial plants, moving their factories out of Germany into the United States, then you're really going to have a problem, because the one thing that the Germans have been very proud of since 1945 has been their economy, the fact that they produce high-quality goods that have absolute extraordinary reputation throughout the world. And if they can't produce that anymore, if they are become an economic basket case, the kind of basket case such as Greece that the Germans tend to mock, then you're going to see real distress. And when the Germans get distressed, then really serious consequences.
If we were to take a look, Paolo Raffone, at the suggestion that the U.S. maybe has this intention, which is, we don't know for sure, but we're seeing that happen in Europe, where out of Germany, for example, companies or factories, I should say, are relocating to the U.S., even though the U.S. and I think Europe or European Union has about $5 trillion in trade between the two. Are we looking at the U.S. really moving forward with that intention in mind when it comes to Europe, where at the end it's going to reap the benefits, but at the cost of Europe?
In part, it is like this. I mean, certainly the neocon group, which is, as you know, transversal between the two main parties in the U.S., which is at the origin of all this dramatic crisis in Europe, has this in mind. I mean, to have Germany pay and Europe continue to pay, because finally Europe has a huge amount of money saved and not invested. So they want to transfer this money in the U.S., which is now printing new money but without savings. So this is certainly their idea. But now, the neocons, will they survive after the 8th of November? This is a question mark, because what will happen probably is that they will be decimated, and a totally different policy will be shaped in the United States. We will see what happens. But certainly what we have seen done by the Democrats and Biden so far will not continue after November. I mean, there would be necessarily a change, at least in one part of the Congress, but probably both. So if this happens, there will be a U-turn also in the United States in terms of policy, and the neocons may be marginalized in some way or another.
All right, last question. I'm going to have to get a reaction from you, George Samioli, because it has taken social media by storm. And that is when the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said, Europe is a garden and the rest of the world is a jungle, where he said the jungle could invade the garden and that the gardeners have to go to the jungle to protect the garden.
In terms of Josep Borrell, he has a tendency to say imbecilic things, because he is an imbecile. But I think probably what he meant is that we in Europe have a very, very nice life, but it's been a very privileged life that we've enjoyed. Cheap energy from Russia, the German economic miracle, with its export-driven economy, and it may all soon come to an end. That 50, 60, 70 years that the Europeans have enjoyed, that comfortable life, may very soon be coming to an end. I think probably that's what he was trying to articulate.
Yeah, we'll leave that to the history books, too. We'll find out how that pans out. Thank you. That was George Samioli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University. Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of SIPPI Foundation from Brussels, thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Vitagwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you, and of course, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. So, dear Sheikh, we have a verse of the Holy Quran that says that Rabb al-Ibad, Allah the Creator, the Lord, He says in His Quran, يَظَلُّ مَنْ يَشَاءُ وَيَهْنِ مَنْ يَشَاءُ. He can either lead astray those who He wishes to lead astray, lead them to corruptions, or lead them away from Sirat al-Mustaqim, from Islam, from the straight path, or He can lead them to Islam, towards Himself, towards righteousness and justice and so on and so forth. So seemingly Allah, He decides who He wants to be a good Muslim, a person who goes to heaven, and He also decides who gets to be a bad person and who goes to hell and gets punished. So seemingly, some would say that the human in question, us who live in this world, in this creation, we have no choice because we are either forced to be mu'mins, believers, righteous people, or we are forced to be bad people. So at the end of the day, if I'm forced to be this way, I'm sinless, am I not, dear Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that in the verses of Noble Quran, we have some verses that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talking about the guiding of some people and misguiding. يُضِلُّ مَنْ يَشَاءُ وَيَهْدِي مَنْ يَشَاءُ. The appearance of these verses of Noble Quran talking about, as we understand from the, you know, shallow understanding of these verses.
Just from translating what is written. These most that, simple level.
Yeah, yeah. It means that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala guides some people and misguides whatever, you know, He likes some other people. So, but you know that if you want to have the, you know, accurate understanding of verses of Noble Quran, you have to check other related verses of Noble Quran.
It doesn't make do just taking one verse out of context.
Exactly.
You need the entire chapter, and often you don't need the tafsir and exegesis of this.
Exactly. You have to look at these verses, because these beautiful verses of Noble Quran are revelation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to mankind. And these are miracle, you know. And these divine verses has some lessons for all people from different generations till the day of judgment. So you should look at it in this unique way, and you have to benefit the most from this verse of Noble Quran. First of all, we know that human being has free will and choice, and it is one of the differences of human being with other creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is very important that by your choice and by your free will, you choose either the evil way, okay, the path of Satan, or you choose the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I want to say that whether you are righteous people or you choose to be from the, you know, wrongdoers. If you choose to be by your free will, we have free will, and everybody knows and feels that.
We say we have free will, dear Sheikh, but then we have this verse that says that Allah decides.
If you choose to be evil doer, in that case, by your